really this is about enabling change. And what we've done over the course of the last couple of weeks is, in open conversations with our clients, serve notice on a number of contracts in advance of Harvest 27, precisely to allow us to look at the arrangements that we have with them and understand, alongside their objectives, what changes are needed. That relates to just under 8,000 hectares of the land that we have on the funded contracting businesses.
One of Britain's biggest farm management companies serves notice on thousands of hectares. We ask, is British farming broken and how do we make it better? A last-ditch extension for mid-tier countryside stewardship, sticking plaster or solution? And three experts give their thoughts on the future for contract farming. Welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. I'm Johan Tasker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
All that and more coming up, but first, our top story. The TV advert for Red Tractor Farm Assurance has been banned for exaggerating the scheme's environmental benefits. The Advertising Standards Authority said Red Tractor provided insufficient evidence that its farms complied with basic environmental laws. It followed a complaint by the environmental group River Action, which accused Red Tractor of greenwashing and misleading the public. Red Tractor Chief Executive Jim Moseley said the advert made no environmental claims, implied or otherwise. Well, to help us make sense of that ruling and its wider implications, we're joined by Amy Jackson, a crisis and reputation management expert specialising in food and farming. Amy, some people are saying that in this instance, at least, Red Tractor is being used almost as a whipping boy for everything that's wrong with UK agriculture.
Well, I think it is actually pretty much about that. I mean, if we look at the facts behind it, it's taken the ASA over 2 years to make this decision about an ad which was first shown in 2021. And it's a really marginal decision, you know, in that Red Tractor can continue to use its farmed with care slogan and can make these claims in the future. It's all about just directing to the particular standards. So I think we need to kind of look at what's going on here and why this action or this complaint was brought in the first place. And I really do believe that, you know, River Action pursued this because they wanted to blame someone or something and to highlight attention on the farming industry because they felt it wasn't getting enough attention for water quality issues. And Red Tractor was simply the proxy for the farming industry. And really the underlying reasons are what we should be worried about, which is, are we really doing enough to focus on air and water quality?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to suggest, Amy, because I think this ruling does have wider implications. And we do make claims sometimes within UK agriculture, either explicitly or implied, that we are doing the right thing for the environment. But the evidence isn't always there to support those claims. And it's really, really important, if we are going to make them, that they are backed up by the data.
Absolutely. And I do hear this all the time, and I understand why people do it. They're proud of their industry and they're proud of what they do. But there's these sort of slogans that get trotted out, like farming's not the problem, it's the solution. Or we have the highest welfare standards in the world. And actually, they become a mantra that no one really knows what's behind it or what evidence there is. And it's quite often not correct. Or if you wanted to qualify, you had to qualify, you wouldn't be able to. And that's worrying because we need to know where we are and we need to be making accurate statements about where we are.
So, Amy, given that and given the decision that was eventually made about this advertisement, is it down to individual farmers to collect the data and the proof and the evidence that this judgment suggests they need to do? Or is it down to the industry as a whole to come up with that information?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, Louise. I mean, there's stuff that individual farmers can do. Like, do you know about your local water quality? Are you measuring ammonia emissions? Are you doing what you can? But equally, I mean, this is what we saw with our response to the claims that we were kind of driving superbug infections through our antibiotic use. It's really helpful to have a centralized response and coordinating body to help make sure the industry has got the right messages, is doing the right thing, is focusing on the right areas. So it's a bit of both. Is we need the individual action, but we also need the industry to take action. And I would say in that, it's not just about this centralized coordination and pointing to the right things. I think we need to take a different tone. Because if we look at the facts and the figures around air and water pollution, it actually isn't that good. What we've got is, if we look in the figures for England, and there's a thing called reasons for a water body not achieving good status, agriculture and land management is the leading cause of that problem. And, you know, that's in front of water companies. Okay, water companies might be leading in serious pollution incidents, but there's a really bad chronic diffuse problem for agriculture that I'm not sure we're actually getting on top of.
Well, let's explore the antimicrobial thing a little bit more, Amy, because there was this perception that farmers, livestock farmers, especially in what many people would see as being intensive production systems, were using antimicrobials more than they should be. Now, yes, there perhaps was a bit of an issue there, but by focusing on that issue, the sector has since shown that it's made great steps in reducing antimicrobial usage. And that is based actually on evidence, not just on hearsay or anecdote.
Well, interestingly, Johan, we were in this state with antibiotics 10 years ago. Back in 2015, every week you could pick up a copy of the Daily Mail and there would be a story about how livestock farming, whether it was pigs or poultry or beef, was driving drug-resistant infections in humans. And the response of the industry at the time was to say, no, it's not. It's medicine that's doing it. You know, we're really responsible. But no one was listening. And this is where you get a really important point, is if you want to be heard and listened, you need to be trusted. And to be trusted, you need to engage in the debate and engage in the issue. And what happened was when we actually turned around and faced the issue and said, look, let's park the blame for the moment and say we all use antibiotics and therefore we all have a responsibility to use them better, more responsibly. So let's all work together to try and improve on this problem. And as soon as we started doing that and actually looking at the data, looking at what we were using, looking at where reductions could happen, then we started to get action. And then we started to get far more trust, because then we could push back on the things that were inaccurate because we were doing our bit. And that's where I think we need to get to with a lot of other issues that we're dealing with, is we just tend to push back and say, no, it's not ours. And in fact, I mean, the Wye River is a really good example of this, because this has been rumbling along for years and years. And it's all about, I don't want to sort of say farmers and poultry companies, but there was a blame from the farming side towards sewage works and natural processes. And then the water companies were blaming farmers, or they're saying our discharges are within permit limits. The regulators were saying we don't have any powers, we need more data. And the politicians were saying it's a cross-border complex issue, you don't want to lose the rural vote. And it's just blame. It's like people standing in a circle pointing fingers at each other. And instead, if back then we'd actually said, look, there's clearly a problem with the river, let's all get together and set up a way in which we can actually test and look for what's happening and treat it as a joint project. And then suddenly people aren't working hard to grab your attention or try and get you engaged or say, we want you to be accountable. We want you to take responsibility. They're saying, oh, great, you know, we can actually do something here. And then you've got some control over what happens. But it's just about, a lot of that noise is about saying, we want to be heard, we want you to listen, we want you to do something, and you're just ignoring us. And as soon as you actually engage and say, yeah, this is a problem, let's do our bit, let's find out what's happening, then suddenly you've got far more control and you've got a far better reputation.
So how do we own this situation then, Amy?
Well, I think we talked earlier about the individual action and then the industry action. On an individual basis, I mean, know what your air and water quality is. Like, understand it. Engage with a testing company, maybe see if there's a local group, water catchment areas, you know, actually work with your local water company. There's lots and lots of group activity going on. So by working in those groups or working with those companies, you can actually start to understand your situation and improve on it. And it gives you a really good defense if someone's asking you questions to say, well, this is what I'm doing. I'm engaging with it. I'm really interested. I want to improve. And that's a really good position to be in. Also, you can look for capital grants. I mean, look, Farming Rules for Water, all the restrictions around the country that farmers are going to have to follow are going to be really difficult given the change in climate and the extreme weather we're getting. So I think people need to look ahead for capital grants, try and make their storage systems, their infrastructure for slurry management more resilient and cope with that better. On an industry basis, I would really like to see some positive engagement. I don't know who that would be from, but some organisation saying, look, let's deal with this issue head on. Let's start looking at where we can improve, help farmers with more information, have some central coordination, and actually, you know, communicate with government and show that we are taking the problem seriously and we're working on it, and maybe be a bit more transparent with information because, hey, these are the challenges we're facing, and this is what we're doing to try and solve it. We haven't got the answer overnight, but we're paying attention and we're doing something about it.
Amy Jackson, reputation management expert for farming. Thanks for joining us here on the Farmers Weekly podcast. Louise, Hugh, we've got to own the claims that we're making when it comes to farming. We've got to measure it to manage it.
Absolutely. And it's not just this problem about environmental, clean air, clean water, clean soil. You could say the same about biosecurity in farmyards. There's a whole host of stuff where we just need to grow up and own it, grow a pair. Our leaders need to lead and stop being worried by, you know, farmers sniping and griping because all this too much red tape, it's too much this. No, you've got to be responsible. And actually, we've got to create some data. She says it in the audio. We've said it all along. You've got to have the data to say, this is fine. There's nothing to see here. Walk away. Let us feed you. You know, it's the sign. I said the other month or whenever it was the other year, when you go to agricultural shows, and you go past all the breed stands for the cattle and they put claims on breeds, you know, the sustainable breed. And none of these are backed up by data. If you actually sat these people down and said, have you tested, have you genomically analyzed these animals? Have you then feed efficiency tested that genomic against that animal, yada, yada, yada? No, they just put it on there because it sounds a bit nice and it's green. It's a bit like saying, we're the best farmers in the world. We're the highest welfare. Yeah, we probably are. That there's bugger all data out there to actually back it up. So we've got to grow a pair, we've got to grow up, and we've got to start leading on this, and we've got to start owning it because we can, and probably, it's probably not as bad as everyone thinks, certainly what farming's responsible for.
Do you know, I was thinking the other day, we haven't had a Hugh rant on the podcast for quite a while, but I think we had one there, Louise. We were talking also on the audio about Red Tractor in this instance being something of a fall guy, a whipping boy for the farming industry, an easy target, as it were.
Well, I think on this occasion, it really has been an easy target. And it's interesting because I have picked up quite a bit of farmer sentiment, and these are farmers who aren't necessarily on the side of Red Tractor, and they're saying, you know, this time they actually feel quite sorry for them because what the advertisement was banned for, they didn't really feel came within the Red Tractor remit. They said that Red Tractor was about animal welfare, provenance and food safety, and yet they were being hammered on environmental claims. Now, this is, as we were saying and with Amy, this is a bigger issue, and Hugh is right that we have all got to take ownership of this, and everyone's got to start collecting this data, and then we've got to use that data in the right way to show how well in some cases we are doing, but also to show where, yeah, we recognise there's an issue here, but we're going to do something about it.
And yet, Hugh, when Red Tractor 18 months or so ago tried to encourage farmers to measure their Scope 3 emissions, their greenhouse gas emissions, farmers basically turned around and said, no, we don't want to do that. We're not going to do it. We don't want to measure anything.
Yeah, the psychodrama that's Red Tractor. Look, Red Tractor's like this, okay? Let us not forget that the industry owns a huge chunk of Assured Food Standards, AFS, which owns Red Tractor, okay? And it's a bit like owning your very own five-star hotel with Michelin-star kitchen and swimming pools, and it does a really good job of being a five-star hotel. Yet you constantly, despite owning this thing, you constantly go onto TripAdvisor saying, oh, I'm not sure about this. Oh, I don't like that. I'm not sure about this. As opposed to promoting it, as opposed to owning it and managing it and running it. And so Red Tractor is I'm afraid to say this, it is the perfect vehicle on which you could combine with owning these problems and delivering back to our, you know, our customers, our consumers, our society as a whole. It is absolutely the vehicle you need to do that. You need to own it. Again, you need to grow a pair, show some leadership, own it, and run it like it works. It's all there for the taking. We just got to take it.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And now a special word with this week's podcast partner, NFU Mutual, and I'm joined by NFU Mutual's Rosie Monk. Rosie, NFU Mutual, not just about insurance, you offer a range of services to farmers.
Yeah, so NFU Mutual offers a wide range of products and services. Our local NFU Mutual agents work closely with farmers and really understand the day-to-day challenges you face. And because they're both based in your community, they're always nearby to offer friendly personal support. The NFU Mutual team do more than just help farmers insure rural properties, vehicles and livestock. We also have expert financial advisors across the UK who are well-versed in the needs of farming businesses, and they're able to support with things like inheritance tax planning and making the most of available reliefs. They can advise on a wide range of NFU Mutual products and others we offer from specialist providers. And they'll take time to explain the services we offer and the charges so that everything's clear from the start. And finally, when it comes to health and safety, we've got NFU Mutual Risk Management Services with specialist consultants who will go out and visit farms to offer practical advice and support.
There's lots of different insurance companies out there, but what makes NFU Mutual different to other insurers?
Yeah, so there's a lot that makes NFU Mutual stand out from other insurers. For starters, our heritage. We were founded by farmers for farmers, and we've been supporting the industry for over 115 years now. So that means we really get farming and the challenges that come with it. We keep things simple and transparent, so there's no admin fees for making changes to your policy and no extra charges for paying monthly by direct debit. We also work closely with farming unions to make sure farmers' interests are front and centre when it comes to industry development. And we also offer mutual bonus, rewarding loyalty and giving customers a saving on the renewal premium of their general insurance policies. But it's not all about the products and services we offer. Beyond insurance, we're committed to supporting the farming community through initiatives that reflect your values and protect your way of life, from educating young farmers and promoting farm safety to tackling rural poverty. We're proud to play a part. In 2024 alone, we donated £3.25 million to causes across the UK and invested over £440,000 to help fight rural crime and support local communities.
So a strong pedigree then, lots of heritage. How are you adapting at NFU Mutual to support farmers in the modern day?
We're always looking ahead at NFU Mutual to make sure our cover keeps up with the way farming is evolving. That means ensuring new tech like automated machinery and developing innovative products like parametric insurance that is triggered by weather events, not just claims. We're also exploring how we can develop offerings to support natural capital projects so farmers can make the most of opportunities in this growing area.
And Rosie, how can farmers get hold of NFU Mutual?
NFU Mutual have over 280 local agency offices across the UK, which means we are always close by. Whether you want to give them a call, send them an email or pop in for a chat, your local office is there ready to help you. You can easily find their contact details by heading to nfumutual.co.uk.
Rosie Monk from NFU Mutual, this week's Farmers Weekly podcast partner. Thank you very much.
The Farmers Weekly podcast.
Now, Velcourt, one of Britain's biggest farm management companies, has served notice on almost 8,000 hectares of contract farming agreements. The move follows three extremely tough years for arable farming, including the phase-out of direct subsidies, the closure of the sustainable farming incentive, and a depressed commodity market. Joining us now is Velcourt Group Chief Executive Nick Shorter. Nick, welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. Some of our listeners will no doubt be thinking, well, you know, if Velcourt can't make a go of things, what hope is there for the rest of us? But this isn't about walking away from contract farming agreements. It's about restructuring and adapting to a world without subsidies.
That's right, Johan. I mean, really, this is about enabling change as opposed to enacting it. What we've done over the course of the last couple of weeks is in open conversations with our clients, serve notice on a number of contracts in advance of Harvest 27, precisely to allow us to look at those businesses, look at that structure, look at the arrangements that we have with them, and understand, you know, alongside their objectives, what changes are needed. That doesn't detract from the, you know, the underlying economics, which, you know, ultimately the root cause of this, which is, you know, I said in my statement, the last 3 years in broadacre and combinable crop farming, particularly in some parts of the country, unsupported, have been pretty tough. And importantly, when you cast that lens further forward, the next 2 years don't look any better. So, you know, this is about recognizing that things need to change and putting the system in place to ensure that those conversations can be had in a timely and professional manner. That relates to just under 8,000 hectares of the land that we have on the funded contracting businesses.
And Nick, I mean, it is a question I think that has been asked before, and that is, you know, are contract farming agreements suitable going forward? You know, would something like share farming be more appropriate given the headwinds and given what's going on in farming at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think my view on that is really, if you're not careful, it ends up being sort of two sides of the same square. I mean, I think the, you know, if I come back to my point about the underlying economics here, I mean, if you just look at a pure combinable crop farm and you take a crop a week, for example, if you assume some constants, so let's say a 9 ton a hectare constant yield throughout, in 2021, you'd have been out the bottom of that arrangement before any sharing of the profit between the parties. You'd have been looking at something like £850 a hectare with £200 of basic payment in it. If you look at that for the 2026 coming year, assuming same yield but applying today's cost of production, you know, that drops to £200 a hectare. So the, irrespective of how the contract shares the outcome from the farming business, whether that's through a share farming arrangement, whether that's through contract farming arrangement, and indeed where the splits between the two parties lie, ultimately this is about the fact that the economics of broadacre combinable crop farming today in 2026 are very different. And therefore, your only mechanism to get a better result than that is either to have higher productivity, lower cost base, or bring in a degree of policy support. And our assessment of this space is that that's achievable on many of our farms, but on some, you know, that's a tough question to answer when the subsidy is no longer coming through. The cost of production, even in some of our most efficient businesses, still results in, you know, a very small amount of net revenue coming out the bottom. And that's before you put any kind of weather effect or shock on yield. That's assuming, you know, an average yield. And obviously, as we know, for the last 3 years particularly, the weather gods haven't aligned in that order. And actually, some of those businesses have had, you know, poorer yields than the long-term average through no fault of anyone other than the weather, which, you know, in turn has a material effect on the bottom line.
If you look at all of that stuff in the round, Nick, I mean, if you look at things like, I guess, soil type, commodity markets, government policy, stroke subsidy, the weather, these are all things that are largely out of farmers' hands. I mean, yes, we can try and build resilience into the business, but what are you looking at the moment as a solution to this?
I think the probably the biggest change that we think needs to happen, and in our own businesses and in the industry generally, and you hit on the nub of it there in terms of your comment about soil type, is the is a move away from having a sort of a constant cost or a constant value associated with farming in general, and that is to say, you know, that all arable land is equal. All arable land carries the same entry cost, whether that's rental equivalent, contract farming charges, whatever it might be. And actually, I think our assessment is it needs to be looked at in much more detail than that. You know, the relative productivity of that land. Increasingly, if you look at the last 3 years of weather pattern, the resilience of that land, you know, is it free draining? Is it able to deal with, you know, periods of extended dry, periods of extended wet without having, you know, significantly detrimental impact on the crop's potential? And there has been a tendency, you know, over the last 25 years, partly because of the underlying subsidy, to say that, you know, all land has a has an equivalent value, and therefore the cost of that to the underlying landowner is consistent irrespective of the output. And I think our contention is that in the future, very much, you know, the productivity of that land, resilience of that land, the ability to produce consistent returns from it is what should command premium in the market, not necessarily the fact that it is land available per se.
Is British farming broken then? Are you saying, Nick, that, for instance, growing cereals on grade three land is no longer economically viable?
I'm not saying it's no longer viable. What I'm saying is that certain soil types, particularly if they're prone to waterlogging or heavier and require, you know, a higher cost base to operate, clearly are going to carry more risk. And, you know, so that's not to say they won't be farming or in crop production in the future. But the underlying economics of the business structure that sits around it, whether it's the relative return to the farmer, the operator, the contractor, you know, need to reflect that inherent risk.
And Nick, Velcourt is well respected for its technical expertise and the training program that your employees go through. So I'm really encouraged to hear you say that it's not a final parting of the ways. So you're not expecting to lose much of that expertise that you've built up over the year, by the sound of it.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, clearly some of these businesses need to go through some change and some understanding of what that will look like in the future. I mean, you know, what I would say is that it is that expertise of the business structures, of the real understanding of the economics of what is capable from this land base or the land base in question that skill set plays into. You know, those managers are some of the best in their game, and you know, they and the clients and the clients' representatives will be looking really hard at what the future look like, how we can match the objectives of all the parties in this. That's as much as the skill set as of the sort of technical skill set that we're perhaps, you know, better known for. And one thing I'd like to get across in this conversation is, you know, Velcourt's not going anywhere. Velcourt will look different in the future, but you know, as any business will do in a time where there's some headwinds, this is about making sure that any change we recognize that needs to be in place in the future, you know, we make those changes ahead of when we need to, not after we should have done.
So Nick, in 5 to 10 years' time, what do you think a Velcourt managed farm will look like? How different will it be to what it looks like now?
Wow, what a great question. I think it will be much more data driven. I think, you know, we're only beginning to scratch the surface in Velcourt and certainly as an industry about, you know, what information, what data will be available and how we can use that. I think ultimately crop production and food, therefore food production, will be more benign. I think we will be using better technology, whether that's through genetics, whether that's through nanotechnology, whether that's through better understanding of the soil system, that will enable us to produce crops in a more benign way, using information technology to enable us to do that. So my view on the future of farming and food production is that it will be cleaner, it'll be more accurate, it'll be more transparent, it'll be more sustainable. I think farms will continue to work together, and you'll see some continued degree of consolidation, you know, in an environment where you have an inflationary cost base and a fixed output price. That's inevitable. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. So I think farms will look very different. I think the supply chain will look very different. But I think that ultimately that will be better for the consumer and better for the underlying farming business itself.
Nick Shorter from Velcourt, thank you very much. Louise, big news, of course, in the arable sector, but to be honest, we can't really be surprised that this is happening.
No, we can't be surprised at all. I mean, for all the reasons that Nick's explained, it's not too happy right now in the combinable crop sector. And really, I would imagine there are an awful lot of farm businesses out there at the moment wondering about whether their particular business model, whatever it may be, is actually fit for the future. So, yeah, I mean, they've struck first. I'm sure other people have already made significant decisions, and we'll be hearing more about those as they come out. As Nick said, then they're not walking away, which has been portrayed a little bit about them. They are actually just restructuring and getting set for what the future holds.
I think for me, though, the key thing is when you change all of the models, depending on how you do that. The one pressure on, though, is still going to be, you know, it's all about attention to detail with costs. That's always been the same. But it really now starts to pull out that, you know, to use the rather sexist old saying, the men from the boys in the sense of the land type and the land quality that you're on. You know, and if you're on good land and you're on, you know, nice ground, you've got half a chance of winning. If you're like me and you're in destitute Surrey on grade three land that struggles to grow anything, you know, you're bottom of the queue for anyone looking for a contract farming type deal. Or if you are getting into one of those, you're not going to get much out of it at all. So it's a real pressure on, isn't it? And driven by the value of the market. But it just goes to show how key over the years those payments have been. But now it's like, who's going to survive this one? Well, it's going to be an interesting one to see, isn't it?
Well, later on in this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast, we will be looking at the prospects for the arable sector in more depth with an expert panel. But first, a short break.
The Farmers Weekly podcast. The Farmers Weekly podcast.
You're listening to the Farmers Weekly podcast. Welcome along wherever you're listening to us from. You can email us podcast@fwi.co.uk. And if you're in the UK itself, you can also message us by texting the word farm, followed by your message to 88440. Louise, some big news for Countryside Stewardship mid-tier agreement holders this week.
Yes, thank goodness. They've seen sense, and those farmers, of which there were over 5,000 of them, whose countryside stewardship agreements came to an end in December, have been granted a one-year extension, probably a little bit too late when you consider some of the things they might have done if they'd known that ahead of time. But of course, the bigger issue here is we can't run stewardship schemes like this. You know, we need a much better decision-making process and a longer-term view.
A longer-term view, a longer-term plan. 70 million that year-long extension is worth to those 5,000 farmers. Hugh, that pales into insignificance almost compared to the apparent £30 billion that Lidl is investing to strengthen the British food industry over the next 5 years.
Yeah, look, that's fantastic, isn't it? Lidl investing all that money. And look, there's a two clear differences here, isn't there? The government is sort of living hand to mouth, like some sort of big issue seller. And the Lidl have a plan, and they're actually moving forward. And they're saying, this is our five-year plan, and we're going to invest £30 billion in UK produce for our customers to sell in our shop over the next 5 years. And, you know, bear in mind that Morrisons have been doing a good job trying to hide the fact they're pulling in Australian meat. Lidl are going out and they're saying, no, we're going to stick with the British stuff and really push it out. So well done them. And let's hope, you know, proof is in the pudding and it gets there. Really good news for all those mid-tier stewardship agreement holders. The fact they're not going to fall off a cliff edge come the end of December. But of course, the question is still, as Louise says, it still needs a plan. We still need a scheme that we can actually budget on, or tell us there's not going to be a scheme. And there's a whole load more people going to fall off a cliff the following year. And then, you know, there's a whole load of SFI 3 years are going to expire in another 18 months' time. So it just, yes, it's sticking plaster stuff, isn't it? Very welcomed and well lobbied, everyone that came out to claim that they won the victory, all the various organisations who have all worked incredibly hard doing it. But yeah, it just needs a plan from government. But at least they've seen some sense and are rolling those over.
A little bit of good news for us here on the Farmers Weekly podcast as well. We won an award, the British Guild of Agricultural Journalists Podcast of the Year Award, the Farmers Weekly podcast winning that award for 2025. So a little bit of a pat on the back for us here on the podcast. And thank you to everybody who has sent us congratulations.
It was really nice, wasn't it, to receive some messages from people who say that it's been very well deserved and that we need to keep up the good work, keep going. They're enjoying it and they seem to want to hear more from us. So there you go.
There you go. They must be mad, mustn't they, Johan and Louise? Gosh. Anyway, it was a lovely award ceremony and a fantastic lunch. And was it Stationers Hall?
Yes, Stationers Hall, one of the great livery companies of the City of London, just off Ludgate Hill, a few minutes walk from St Paul's Cathedral, no less, and about, for those that know, it's about a 10-minute walk from Smithfield Market. Always nice to enter an award, even better when you're a winner, Hugh. So, yeah, well done us. That's really good. But back to earth with a bump, though, dare I say, Hugh. The markets, in association with the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board, any winners there?
Thank you very much, Johan. Finished their dead weight this week, 645.5. Edged up slightly. It's gone up about 0.8 of a penny on the week. Just to bear in mind that a year ago, that was 512.4. So it's considerably more than it was. Finish steer live weight, 363.8. That has dropped back 6p on the week. On to sheep. Lambs. Now we are, last week it was diesel that was the number of the devil. This week, lambs. The deadweight SQQ is 666 pence, 0.1. So it's not quite. That's dropped back from 678.3 last week. But again, look at the 12-month, 617.5 was the average this time last week. So those lamb prices, all those red meat prices, still really strong because supply is constraining, or numbers are constraining supply. Numbers are short. Although the lamb job is strong and store prices have been really strong this week because everyone's stubble turnips look fantastic in most parts of the country. And so that's really driving some store prices on as well. Live weight lamb price SQQ £3.08 or £3, 300 pence, 0.8. So that's dropped back two pennies on the week. Onto the pig price, 205.3. That drops back half a penny on the week. Arable markets, feed wheat 164 dead this week. It's gone back 20p. Milling wheat 175 dead. That's gone back £2.60. Feed barley 142.8. That's actually gone up by £2.80. It must be all those rich sheep and beef farmers buying the barley to feed them. Oilseed rape 398.1. That goes up marginally, about a pound, less than a pound on the week. Feed peas 203.4. That's gone up about a tenner. Feed beans 205.2. That has gone back £4 on the week. And diesel, no longer the number of the devil, like the lambs. It's 66.86 pennies. So it's actually gone up marginally by about 0.2 of a penny, but still not bad value.
Thank you, Hugh. And for trusted market data delivered straight to your inbox, visit the AHDB Preference Centre at ahdb.org.uk/market-data to sign up for and customise AHDB market emails.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
At Avant, we create solutions to improve your livestock farming. Our compact loaders handle daily demands with ease. From feeding and bedding to cleaning and maintenance. With powerful hydraulics, a compact design, and a quick attach system, you can switch attachments quickly, navigating narrow barns and tight pens effortlessly. Our durable and reliable machines save you time and effort. Join countless livestock farmers who trust Avant to keep their operations running smoothly. Avant, your trusted partner in livestock farming. Search for Avant now.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, we heard earlier in the episode about Velcourt serving notice on 20% of its contract farming agreements, a reflection of just how tough it is out there, especially for the arable sector. So what should farmers do? Well, to discuss the options, we're joined by three farm business consultants, Rachel Bush from Ceres Rural, James Seven from GSC Grays, and Richard Taylor from Strutton Parker. Rachel, we'll start with you. Velcourt won't have taken this decision lightly. And as we've said, it is tough out there. We know that. This is something that you've been looking into.
Yes, it is a tough world out there at the moment, and it is getting harder, and we're seeing that the amount of land in contract farming agreements is going down. Now, that kind of goes hand in hand with more businesses using SFI and countryside stewardship to bolster their income, and quite a lot of landowners are taking some aspects of that environmental stewardship out of the agreement. But on the flip side of that, we're also seeing, and I can back this up with conversations that I've had, is the average contractor's charge per hectare is going up. So 2023, we were looking at an average contractor's charge of £286 a hectare. And then looking forward to 2025, that is creeping up to £300 a hectare. And then the farmer's basic return, so that's what they get for providing the land into the agreement. In 2023, that was an average of £242 a hectare. And we're looking at 2025, an average of £212. So it's a reflection of where we see negotiations are going as contract farming agreements come up for renewal.
Rachel, thank you. Richard Taylor up in Yorkshire, these schemes that people have been relying on, I mean, some have come to an end. The future's rather hazy.
Our main concern going forward is that the certainty of these schemes, when we'd be looking at business planning 20 years ago, we were looking at 10-year countryside stewardship schemes as being the norm. Then that reverted back down to 5-year ELS schemes, then 3-year SFI schemes. And now we're not really knowing from year to year what's coming. So it is very difficult from a policy point of view to be planning long term with these agreements. Again, I think a lot of these agreements are being renewed on year-to-year basis. And I suspect Belcourt, like other larger contractors, are looking at their cost structure and thinking, well, we can't just budget from year to year. So going forward, it's both parties looking at their own cost structures and seeing how it works for them and what the alternatives are.
One of the things that has been mentioned quite a few times when farmers are looking at these agreements is the role that the weather has played and the amount of risk that they are having to take on. Is that something that you are hearing from your clients, whichever side of this that they sit on? And is a fair return for both parties still possible in the current climate?
A fair return for both parties. James Seven from GSC Grays, what do you think?
I think for me, in terms of performance and production, it's certainly a time when one needs to look to optimise anything you can do to make more production more efficient. For example, looking at land selection, looking at cutting out awkward corners, tough headlands, north-facing slopes, whatever it is, to make sure that the agreement is farming the best land available in the most efficient manner. And then you look at the minutiae, the detail of how you then apply contractors' fees and costs only to the land that is actually farmed, and maybe looking at varying the price in terms of what actual operations are undertaken. So you're always trying to optimize the net return from the agreement. Now, clearly, cutting out land from direct production has been assisted greatly by the availability of schemes, whether they be CSS, mid-tiers or SFIs, so margins, extended fallows, legume fallows. And as you say, the certainty around those going forward is questionable. But nevertheless, looking for optimum efficiency must be something to help with. And in terms of managing a contract farming agreement, I always describe it as making a cake and then cutting up that cake in a fair and reasonable manner. And so asking questions now about reviewing your agreement, reviewing its ingredients, reviewing the returns to both parties, how it's constructed, how it's managed is crucial so that you can actually arrive at a system that actually can continue to work for both parties, or decide that it doesn't and maybe look for an alternative.
In some ways, parts of this we've talked about and we've known it's been coming, particularly around the payments since Brexit. And then since 2019, and then the doubt over policy structure and all of the, well, what we're just seeing it now, aren't we, with not much at all on offer. Is it feasibly possible? Because the cynics in the room, and certainly me personally, I'm budgeting for no support at the moment. Is it possible in your world of contract farming to do the same and still make some return?
Looking at the performance of the top 25% performing farms, up here, by and large, the contractors in the contract farming arrangement or farmers themselves are farming families rather than the large corporate contractors. Just looking at what makes a top 25% performing farm and giving some indication where people might be looking, the yield stroke output only made up about 10 to 30% of the extra profit. The main reason why farms were performing in the top 25%, and we analysed it down to about 65 to 90% of that extra profit for those top performing farms, came from lower costs. So I think the indication is that people, pretty by and large, given the weather, given the soil type, are not doing too bad a job on the output. It's the cost structure that probably makes the difference between a farming business farming in its own right or where they're offering contract services. And offering contract services may be one of the reasons why farmers can operate at lower cost, because they're spreading their overheads. Looking carefully at the cultivation and drilling techniques, for example, looking at controlled application of inputs using GPS satellite technology. So that may be a reason why one farmer can offer contracting services at a cheaper rate than others do. So I think, you know, when James says about choosing the contractor, that's one of the reasons why you might be selecting a contractor who operates at a lower cost base and can work within the constrictions of the farming system.
You almost seem to be saying, Richard, that family farms and smaller contractors are better placed to ride out the storm than larger farm management companies.
I think the farming families who operate contract farming as well as their own farms are in a position perhaps to tighten their belt a little bit more in hard times, delay perhaps changing, replacing machinery. They're making the decisions themselves, and they're probably operating in a slightly smaller scale, or more than likely operating in a slightly smaller scale than Belcourt are, who will have a cost structure relating to managing large farming businesses probably from year to year.
I think that's the key point, Richard, isn't it? It's the cost structure that, although, you know, a highly professional, extremely competent outfit like Belcourt is, the cost structure will be significant. And for smaller contract farming opportunities, you know, we've often found over many, many years that the professionally well-run local family farm offers the better chance of getting those cost structures right for the delivery of a contract farming agreement.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we just negotiated a new one, and you know, we're looking at getting the basic contracting fee right, and if there's a bonus, there's a bonus. But we wanted to make it clear that the contractor could operate within the basic, and you know, we've established that, and that's more likely to move successfully forward than perhaps one where the contractor's relying on a bonus out of the system every year to cover his own costs. So again, it's selecting the operational type and possibly location relative to the host farm, if you like.
And Rachel, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I mean, it's not the first time that we've heard Belcourt say that they were looking into what contract farming agreements were working for them and what weren't, and obviously they've made a decision, and it possibly could be a really brave decision and good decision for them. They've looked at their costs, they've evaluated what's going on, and they've realised that actually they do need to cut some of their agreements. I do think potentially that a family-focused farm that's next door could be a better option in terms of they have significantly more control on what costs they do. But what Velcourt are very good because they've got that management structure there. They know their costs. They know absolutely everything down to the penny. What we need to progress in the industry is that the family farms who are farming 1,000, 1,500 acres are looking at their fixed costs at the same way and making sure that they understand where most of their cost base is. Is it in because they're replacing machinery too much? Is it because they've got too much labour, too much horsepower? So we just need to make sure that, yes, the family farm could be the better alternative or could ride the storm a little bit more, but we make sure that they are covering their costs. And as others have said, making sure that they're not reliant on the profit, on the divisible surplus, that they're actually covering their costs with the contractor's charge.
So some of those lower performing areas of land, they will have been put into the SFI. And the SFI has, of course, altered cost structures quite a bit. How are agreements working now that the SFI has come along? Because that land still needs managing, doesn't it?
In terms of managing non-productive areas under SFI, under countryside stewardship, in occasions they are included within the contract farming agreement. But by and large, I think on more on our Yorkshire farms, they are excluded from the contract farm agreement, and the landowners stroke farmers have taken those back in hand to manage themselves, usually with assistance from the contractor on an operational basis. But the environmental benefits very much often favoured by the landowners, looking after game, looking after birds and wildlife. They like to take that back in hand themselves rather than perhaps leaving it at the operational basis for the contractor to look after.
So looking forward, guys, presumably with all of this potential churn that might happen with land, particularly in the more traditional management process or more traditional contracts that, or more traditional contractors that might feel that they don't want to take on land, this opens up opportunity for other people to contract farm some of this land. What would your message be to, I don't know, younger members of farming families with beautifully tightly run systems that know their costs? How do they get into this? How do they get out there and sell their stall to the people like you, particularly the people like you that are acting for owners that aren't farmers hanging around in pubs with surplus land they're trying to dive off to someone?
I think it's a really good question, that, because I do think this is a time when there may actually be significantly increased opportunity for just such operators, or indeed, as we've discussed earlier, the professional farming families. Maybe that is the opportunity, that there is another family member now coming through who could be given responsibility with the backing of the business to take on an opportunity. So I think focus very carefully on budgeting, particularly carefully for any opportunity that comes in front of them, but make themselves, in terms of your other question about how do they project themselves into the marketplace, let them make themselves known to firms like ours, so that we know that they are potential candidates should our clients or other opportunities arise that need their services.
I completely agree with James. It is make yourself known, but also when you have an opportunity, if you've been invited to tender somewhere, it's sort of basic thing. People in farming, especially, people go for people. They don't go for a service, they go for the personal touch. So if you get an opportunity to tender, make yourself presentable. Do a good tender that's detailed and expresses the wishes of the wants to know and everything like that. And when you meet them on farm and they come and see your farm, make sure you talk about it enthusiastically. And it's just, it's presentation skills as much as anything else, really. The finances are important, but with contract farming agreements, what we hope when we're putting one together is longevity. And if people get on, then it will make difficult conversations, which we all have to have when finances aren't good. It makes them a little bit easier, and it makes it a little bit more understandable about where things are going. So I think it's being prepared in front of landowners and in front of agents like myself, and being prepared to open up about what has gone wrong and what has gone right and what you plan to do if something hasn't gone quite to plan or things like that.
I would say when contract opportunities arise, some of them are advertised, some of them aren't. And those that are advertised, a good CV a good interview, good figures go well. Those that aren't advertised and are done really by word of mouth, often it's having your ear to the ground. It's having CVs in with the agents, it's possibly having a personal recommendation, I think is quite important. And seeing if you're working somewhere else, very often a lot of word of mouth goes on between landowners, and we get to know who the good operators are in the vicinity. So, it's having good local networks and being aware that something might be coming up and getting a message into the agents that you are interested.
Some opportunity and upside then from what continues to be a challenging situation for the arable sector. James Seven from GSC Grays, Richard Taylor from Stratton Parker, and Rachel Bush from Ceres Rural. Thank you for joining us here on the Farmers Weekly podcast. And that's about it for this episode. We do hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you really like what you've heard, please do leave us a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with all the latest news, views, and analysis of all the big stories affecting UK agriculture. But for now, I'm Johan Tusker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
Thank you for listening.